This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
Hello, good morning. I'm Noelle Lim. Think tanks can play an instrumental role in influencing government policies and pushing for change through their ideas, research and soft power. To tell us more is Harizal Hazri, the CEO of the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, or known as ISIS Malaysia. Welcome to the show. You've done developmental conflict resolution and civil society work and also worked in more than a dozen countries, for example, Afghanistan and Myanmar. What will be some of your priorities at ISIS?
Well, I think definitely Malaysia is a country that is moving from, you know, being a middle income to a high income nation. And we are certainly now at a middle high income sort of like status. What country, what role do we want to play? So this is some of the key issues that I think we have to look at. I've always been interested to look at the, you know, how Malaysia can address this issue of how we deal with our younger population or the children in Malaysia, because I don't think we have a very strong policy, you know, for young people in Malaysia. And I'm really, you know, I really mean, you know, a child from basically the age of like, you know, one day to sort of like, you know, 7 years old. Interesting is that that has also impacted women in general. So we did a little sort of like study and we found that, you know, women's productivity kind of either plateaued or actually regressed at the point when they have children. Now, that actually tells quite a lot, you know, about how the urban community, especially working mothers, are basically finding it stressful in managing sort of like, you know, the household, their children, as well as to basically try and be productive at work. That also relates to how we don't have a proper childcare policy in the country. We do not have proper, childcare centres, and we have been so independent with the help, yeah, foreign help mainly, to manage our households. Because if we don't address this, we don't address our early childhood education, we don't address, you know, the most important labor force in this country. And I say it again, the most important labor force in this country is women.
But generally speaking, the return on investments can be very high or maybe the highest if we intervene early on at that child stage, right?
I think, you know, there first needs to be realization about the issue that, you know, we first need to do, you know, in-depth studies, which we are doing at ISIS. We need to have strong data. We need to have strong research. We need to make comparisons, you know, what other countries are doing. We need to see the impact on economy and so on and so forth. But yes, to answer your question, the idea is to really get to a point where we actually have a blueprint and basically a storyboard, you know, moving forward, how are we going to address this?
In the past, or maybe even still now, having the years of the Prime Minister or any senior minister is a measurement of success of any think tanks. But now information access is democratized. Governments are becoming more populist than rational. And the younger TikTok generation are bold and empowered. What do you see the role of think tanks like ISIS changing over time?
Well, I think you know, that is definitely an existential question, not just to ISIS, but a lot of think tanks around the world. But I think really, Noel, I think the reality is that this actually strengthened the roles of think tanks, because more and more people have very limited attention time, right? And you're talking about the TikTok generation. They make a, you know, 1 minute video and then they solve
30 seconds.
Like, you know, problems, or maybe 10 seconds, right? But we do know governments need more than that. You know, we governments need specific sort of like group of people who invest in thought, sort of like, you know, leadership, right? Who thinks through this problem and spend actually more time to look at different instances and different issues and how to sort of like, you know, present this in the best, you know, independent way as possible. Like, you know, one of my predecessors, you know, the late Nordin Sopi, used to say that, you know, think tanks like ISIS is actually the third face of the coin, right? Because, you know, we are supposed to come in with something that is very different. We're supposed to come in and give this alternative, creative sort of like idea, but well researched and well thought of, definitely, right? For governments to consider. So although I think generally society feels like, oh, you know, we don't really need think tanks because we can send a message on Twitter and the minister will respond immediately. Now, on one hand, that's true. You don't really need ISIS to bring that voice forward. But on the other hand, that one message on Twitter is not going to be helpful to develop a policy, right? You need specific people who invest in time to look into this properly and to present the case. And not just think tanks. I really think that government needs to have different views and different options, you know, in thinking about this. So definitely TikTok is going to be one of them. Definitely, you know, Twitter is going to be one of them. But more importantly, I think, Noel, is a separate question here. It's really the tradition of respecting ideas and data that I think we need to really cultivate in Malaysia, right? Now, this respect and tradition is all well present in the West. You know, you have almost everything that is documented, right? You have almost everything that is properly documented and then presented back, you know, for public use, you know, either from universities or whatever. Even classified documents will be declassified after a period of time, right? Now, the thing is that we need to really cultivate this culture moving forward in Malaysia. And this is very important because without that respect, and I always say, see this, right? People say that, oh, you know, you write lengthy reports at ISIS, no one's going to read it. Now, that's the problem to begin with. You cannot have a 2-page report if it's so rich in data. You know, the graph itself is going to be 3 pages long, right? The problem is really that, you know, although we want to be concise, you know, we can only be concise after if we have understood the issue in depth, right? Then we can be concise. If we don't have that understanding, it's very difficult to be concise. So this is the thing. The culture needs to really be promoted in this country. Universities, students especially, and this is my worry because, you know, I have kids as well. And I see that, you know, they read 2 sentences and they make a conclusion of, you know, the history of the Industrial Revolution, for instance. So this is a bit problematic, right? So I think it's even getting more challenging now with the generation that have limited sort of like, you know, time for, you know, to deal into the data. But also, you know, that should not stop us to cultivate this respect for that investment. And then only we can get to a point where we can have that rich sort of like, you know, product that we can present back to the community.
About the lack of culture in respecting and appreciating the use of data, one problem is we don't teach math very well in schools. While there is a small group of students who win medals at the Math Olympiad, Malaysian students on average score very low on PISA.
It's got to do with many different things. I don't think I can pinpoint, you know, one single reason to why it is. You know, you talk to an anthropologist, they'll give you one, you know, reason. You talk to an economist, another reason, a historian, another reason. I think it's a mix of many different things, you know. We know this is a problem, and that's more important. And this is what we need to do to try and cultivate this, especially in schools, in young people. Have the respect for that, you know, have the respect for spending a little bit more time off your screen and opening a book, for instance, you know. Go back to the library, you know, do things like that. Get excited about research. Get excited about asking more questions. Don't settle for the 101 for dummies, you know, kind of thing, you know. I mean, we've got to do a little bit more than that. But this, you know, from my point of view, this angle could possibly be addressed as well if we have a good early childhood education. You know, we can't talk to people who are in their 20s and 30s about this and expect them to change, because it's that whole sort of like process that they have gone through. This is best cultivated at a very young age, and I think that's very important for us.
Who is funding ISIS, and how do you manage any potential conflict of interest, or how do you maintain independence?
Right, so ISIS is actually a company limited, registered as a company limited by guarantee. We are an independent body. We're not part of the government. We do ask for, appropriation. Yeah, we do ask for some support from the Malaysian government. Apart from that, we work based on projects. We work with other governments as well. We work with multinational corporations, foundations, wherever possible. So our funding is basically coming from, to simplify it, coming from two different sources. One is the more I call the more secure and stable general funding, and that's normally coming from the government of Malaysia. And the other side is program-based funding, and this is based on the research activities that we do. Now, how do we maintain our independence? I think one good thing, I am always a practical person, right? I see things how it is. It's a bit of a problem, being the chief executive of ISIS. Every time I say something good with the government, they say that I'm actually influenced, and I have to say good things about the government. When I say not so good things about the government, they say that, Harizal is being too critical. Maybe he's aligned to a different, opposition camp or something like that. That's not the case, we have been notoriously, since Nordin Sopi, throughout all the different executives at ISIS, we have notoriously been very independent. If one out of the 10 ideas that we present to the government independently, only one is accepted, that's good enough. Right? Because to me, that will make a huge impact. It's not easy, but I also have to say this, and I don't mean to say this because I want to just basically say good things about the government. I am actually glad. I have worked in more than 12 countries in the world, right? More than a dozen countries. And I am actually quite glad that my home country, Malaysia, the government in Malaysia actually values some kind of independence. I'm actually quite glad. So I can assure and I can tell you there is absolutely almost no government influence and intervention. And in fact, I will also tell you that they don't like us to tell them that what they are doing is always right. They don't like that. And I think that's a good thing, right? They want ISIS to be critical because that's our role.
I'm speaking with Harizal Hazri, CEO of ISIS Malaysia. Shortly after this, we'll get his take on our foreign policies and the National Recovery Plan. Stay tuned.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Hello, I'm speaking with Harizal Hazri, CEO of ISIS Malaysia. Early this month, China sent 16 military aircrafts over disputed waters off the eastern side of Sarawak. How do you read this move?
So first of all, I think the key word is disputed, right? So as much as we feel that, this is infringing on our, territory, to be fair, the Chinese would claim that this is actually their territory. So that's the big problem here, right? So the way I look at it, this is going to continue to be a sticking point in terms of relations between Malaysia and China. I think the Malaysian government's stand is very clear. We want a productive and a productive, workable relationship, diplomatic relationship. What it means is that a productive, workable diplomatic relationship basically means that we have good relationship, we continue to discuss, but we do not basically give up our sovereignty, right? So that is a red line for Malaysia. So for every time this will happen, for instance, we will basically voice our concern. We will send our diplomatic note. We will basically, in layman's term, complain. And we will do our best to defend our sovereignty and territory. But it doesn't mean that this will impact, generally off of all of our relationship with China. I think Malaysia and China enjoy a close trading relationship. We have to understand Malaysia has always been a very significant trading nation, even from the days of Kesultanan Melayu Melaka, for instance, until today, that's really in our DNA. So we survive as a nation based on that more than anything else. And our ability to be diplomatic also drives comes from, us being very practical as a trading nation. Now, to me, that is a very important moving forward. However, we have to understand there are serious hard security issues that we will need to continue to address, and we will address it as a nation.
Is there something that Southeast Asia can do better collectively in standing up against China?
That's a very good question, Noel. I think, ASEAN centrality is very important. I always believe in multilateralism because I believe in the old saying that goes, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, you go together, But so there's so many different sort of like layers to this. We know South China Sea, the claimants of South China Sea also includes other ASEAN countries. So that's also complicated because it's not just about Malaysia, China. It's also Malaysia, Philippines. It's also Malaysia, Vietnam, and Vietnam, China, and Vietnam, Philippines.
How important is it for ASEAN to align ourselves more strongly with the US in order to strengthen our case or our position against China?
So I think, first of all, it is not in ASEAN's sort of like DNA to take sides or to think that we should be closer to either America or China. But on the other hand, although we remain independent, or you know, we want to try and be as independent as we can, and it's not always straightforward because ASEAN also is a collective, right? So within this sort of like different layers of relationship and power struggle, I think ASEAN needs to define where it stands. It has been doing well, but it needs to do more.
And what is more?
We have to look at how ASEAN can contribute first, you know, before we talk about international or the global scale of how ASEAN can do more with the countries within ASEAN itself, right? We know that it's a crisis in Myanmar. We know that countries in ASEAN has always voiced this concern, and not just Myanmar in general, also the crisis in Rohingya, right? And we know that this is turning into not just a political crisis, it is turning into, or it has the elements to basically develop into a civil war. I think, you know, ASEAN first have to concentrate on how it can really play a productive role to address some of these issues. We have issues of our environment as well. Probably now we are forgetting about the haze because there's so many lockdowns until there's no haze last year. I think that was one good thing about it. But, you know, once we are post-pandemic, I'm pretty sure it'll come back, you know. So, you know, how do we deal with this? Then definitely as an association, we can grow stronger. Then definitely we can have a stronger say when we have to deal with other powers outside ASEAN.
ASEAN countries, they themselves need to clean up their act within their own country, like, for example, the environment or even human rights abuses, before they can actually even come together and start telling each other what to do.
Totally agree with you, Noel. I mean, that's absolutely right. You know, the first step is always clean our household, right? And then we can start, you know, engaging with our neighbors. But in cleaning our households, sometimes we need some support, right? We need some support from our neighbors. We need ideas, you know, and some of these issues is not just about our household. You know, if we talk about environment, it is transnational already. So, you know, some of these are not clear cut, but I totally agree with you in all of these issues. We really need to grow this, this need or this want to make it better for ourselves first. And then we can get to that forum, at the ASEAN level.
Would encouraging US to come back to the Trans-Pacific Partnership help to accelerate working together and also balance the superpowers?
Actually, you know what? From my opinion, I don't think they have a choice, quite frankly. I think, you know, at some point...
They, as in the US?
The US, yeah, you know, I mean, I think at some point they'll probably look and be inclined to sort of like, you know, play a role in the TCTPP. But obviously there are concerns, right? These things are, you know, we talk at the higher level of what the Trans-Partnership Program is. And then on the other hand, we have all these sort of like, you know, internal policies that countries would have to deal with. You know, if you look at RCEP, now Malaysia is signatory to RCEP, but, you know, we still have to basically look into the details, and we have to basically, you know, pass the resolution soon. Now, this is not easy for countries, and I think United States of America is finding itself a little bit sort of like, you know, not in line with some of the sentiments or some of the things that is promoted within the TPP. But, you know, these are the things that they have to deal with. But I think moving forward, quite frankly, it makes more sense for the US to be a part of the TPP.
And to bring our conversation home, there is the National Recovery Plan or Exit Plan, what some people like to call it. When we speak to several industry players, many say better to have a plan, even if it is late or incomplete or even a bad plan. But in your opinion, what more can be done? What more can be added in this plan?
No, I definitely think that the plan is a kind of a vision. You know, it gives us, you know, some kind of a vision on how to move forward. But what's really needed is how we basically enhance the plan, right? We know that there are sort of like, you know, three main points in order sort of like, you know, to define whether if we could move forward or not, you know, within sort of like these different stages. I think those are very helpful sort of like indicators. However, I think what is really needed is, how do we enrich this? How do we use, you know, this period to better have coordination between government and society, for instance? I quite frankly think that, we are finding it difficult in Malaysia because ourselves, right, from individuals to communities, we do not have that sense of ownership on how we can fight this pandemic together with the government. It has always been quite a top-down approach in Malaysia, where I feel that, with the level, different levels of sort of like, community associations or groups that we have in Malaysia, we could actually empower all these different groups to play its role. And that is something that, what I mean by, how we can sort of like, feel this sort of like recovery plan better. Because you see, the recovery plan is not a one-way street. It doesn't mean that if we pass from stage one and we go to stage two, it doesn't mean that we can't go back to stage one, right? And this is going to be very painful for Malaysia if we keep on doing one to two and then two to three and then three back to two and two back to one, right? Because it's kind of like never ending. So I think this is how, this is why we really need really strengthen the togetherness of all Malaysians, different sort of like levels to work together.
Well, 15 months later, since the start of the pandemic, why is this sense of ownership missing?
I really think, it has got to do with, a little bit of the history of our country, right? Malaysia is one of those countries in the world that has always been quite, top down in terms of, how we deal with issues and how we address, notwithstanding the fact that, yes, we have opened up quite a lot since like maybe 20 years ago. I still remember when I was in university, this was like not even the area that you should be talking about. You should just wait for the government sort of like, approach and you follow, right? But now it's different. So we are opening up a little bit. But your question is a very important one, right? Why are we still waiting for somewhat or some kind of a move? And why can't we sort of like instigate or initiate that sort of like, solidarity or maybe solidarity is not the good term, but how do we work together to address this? And I think really the strengthening of non-governmental organizations, the strengthening of independent sort of like, community sort of like based, networks. And this is what is needed in Malaysia, because at the end of the day, in the world today, we have realized that, the government's business is really not to be in the business of, of managing its society. It's becoming more and more that. Right. So government should slowly minimize its sort of like, influence or direction and empower community more. And I feel like that's the way moving forward. But we're not there yet. We are moving towards that and more needs to be done.
ISIS is ranked number 4 among 110 think tanks in South and Southeast Asia and the Pacific, excluding India in 2020, according to Global Go 2 Index. Singapore and Indonesia, a couple of think tanks there, are at the top. How important are rankings for ISIS? And what would it take to be number one on that list?
I'm not a big fan of ranking, quite frankly. I think, it's kind of helpful at times, but if we look too much into rankings, it's a little bit counterproductive. I think what's really important for ISIS is to basically become better. And that's my vision, right? If you look at the average age group in ISIS, I'm actually quite happy because we're quite young. Right, so meaning there is a sense, not including me, Noel, so don't get me wrong.
Have you pulled up the average age?
I'm kind of like, pulling that statistics, bigger age. But anyways, if we can have the best Malaysian talent, we can give them the space, right, to be critical, to study, and to really present and realize the issues that actually really affects them, as well as, the country. That would definitely bring us to the top.
I wish you all the best. Thank you for speaking with us and please stay safe. Harizal Hazri, CEO of ISIS Malaysia. I'm Noel Lim on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.